Hello, welcome to the Two Johns podcast. John G. here. This episode of the podcast is a special Little 500 and interview only show. We will talk to three riders, past and present, past, present, past. We'll start off with Adam Giles, who was a founding member of the Cutters team and won the race in the 80s. Then we'll move on to a new rider. He's a rookie in the race this year, named Will Hobart. Lastly, we will talk with Chris Gutowski, who rode on the team that became the Cutters and has been around cycling for a long, long time. The Little 500 is an event, an intramural race at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. It's this weekend on April 21st, Saturday. And if you didn't know what the race is, perhaps you've seen the movie Breaking Away, where the race is featured at the end. That movie was the inspiration for many, many people, myself included, to, you know, to start bicycle racing or to take the race seriously, take bicycle racing seriously. And it does feature in our conversation with Chris. The Two Johns podcast is supported by you at our Patreon site, patreon.com/twojohnspodcast. We very much appreciate that. We also like to hear from you. If you have a question for us, send it please to twojohnspodcast@gmail.com. We'll be back, John and I, with a normal show next time. And once again, thank you to Adam Giles, Will Hobart, and Chris Gutowski for speaking with me. Enjoy. On the Two Johns podcast, we have Adam Giles. Hello, Adam.
Hello, John.
Welcome. Thanks for taking the time to talk.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Adam Giles, you're now in Orlando, but you are from Indiana. You attended the university, or Indiana University, as an undergrad, and you got your graduate degree there as well, I think.
I did, yes.
And while an undergrad, Adam, you were part of the Cutters cycling program, you were on the inaugural team.
Yes, we were the first Cutters team in 1984. That's correct.
And in that
over 30 years ago,
in that race, you were on the bike and crossed the finish line, arms aloft, posting up.
Yes, a great experience for sure.
Going into the race, the expectation of the team from the race organization and other teams was what? What did people think of the Cutters that first year?
I suppose the team was a bit of a novelty in that it was the one of the first teams in a very, very long time that was not Greek. That actually had a good chance to win the race. Prior to our win, the race, I think, had been really dominated by the fraternity system and the Greek houses. I think there was only one other team prior to our win that had that was not Greek that won race.
And those teams, they call them independent teams?
Yes, they were called independents. Yes. We were connected with the old Delta Chi team, which I guess gave the us as individuals, you know, quite a bit more recognition among those that watched the race. And then, of course, the name that we chose obviously was well known in Little 500.
Why?
Oh, because of the movie, the movie Breaking Away. Sorry, I guess I should have given you that background. So the movie Breaking Away, which was written by a guy named Steve Tesich, and Steve rode in the Little 500 in the 60s, I believe, and he wrote this quasi-fictional account of a team called the Cutters that were not students at Indiana University, but that were admitted to ride in the Little 500, which was a real event. So it's fictional in that regard, and it is a great coming of age movie about four high school four recently graduated high school students making the transition to adulthood. Fantastic movie, Academy Award winner.
So you chose the Cutter name, and the Cutter team came out of the Delta Chi fraternity team. Did you ride for Delta Chi before the Cutters?
I did. Myself and actually all the members of the original Cutters team were members of the Delta Chi fraternity at Indiana University and had ridden in the Little 500 prior to that. I guess I should qualify that with my first attempt at the Little 500 was with the Delta Chi team, and we didn't qualify for the race in 1983, which was a tremendous disappointment and a big and a big event in that the Delta Chi team had dominated the race for a number of years. So the fact that we didn't make the field was big news.
So you went from not qualifying in 1983 to winning in 1984.
Correct. On a new team.
But you say the riders on the Cutters were also Delta Chi riders.
Yes. And so due to, a series of circumstances, we didn't, we were not members of the Delta Chi fraternity after that 1983 race or a qualification attempt, and we formed our own group, our own team, and all of the support system and other folks that were involved in what we called the program sort of followed us to the independent team. Which has since that initial victory in 1984, I think I just actually read in the paper as I was trying to catch up on what was happening in the race this year, we've won 12 races since that time.
That's correct. So the selection of the name Cutters, you chose the name Cutters after, as you say, leaving, you put it politically, delicately, you left the Delta Chi, and did you choose the name Cutters as sort of like a middle finger toward the old team, or why choose Cutters? Was it you're trying to make a statement?
Didn't after we parted ways with the fraternity. This would have been in the fall of over the summer actually of 1983 was when this occurred, and we made the decision at that time to form the independent team with all of the riders from that 83 team plus a couple others that were also members of Delta Chi. And we didn't, to be quite honest with you, John, we didn't talk about the name that the new team would have until really a week or so before we actually had to submit a name prior to qualifications, a long, long time after. We were just so focused on wanting to win that race. We didn't, the name never crossed our minds. And the name was actually a suggestion from two former members of the Delta Chi team, both Hall of Fame Little 500 riders, Gary Rybar and Bill Brisman, who I think at the time were both living in California. And Randy Strong, one of my teammates on the original Cutters team, we shared an apartment, and they called us a couple days before that you know, day we had to submit a name and said, you know, we think you guys should call the team the Cutters. And that their connection, obviously, to Littlefly was through Delta Chi. But Gary was the Gary Rybar was the stunt double for Dennis Christopher in the movie Breaking Away. So all of the if you watch the movie or you've seen it, all of the video, all the footage of you know the Cutter rider, the lead Cutter rider, you know, in the actual race situation, is Gary.
And I believe Bill. Also behind the truck, drafted
correct,
behind the
correct.
Truck.
The very famous scene riding behind the truck was Gary. And Bill was also in the movie and was the stunt rider for the fraternity team that got second in the sprint to Dennis Christopher's character. So. Yeah, so their connection was obviously to the movie. They said, we think you should call it the Cutters. It's a perfect story given the circumstances with which you were, you know, summarily, I'll just say, dismissed from the fraternity. And, you know, sort of the rest is history, as they say. And I do remember one of my, you know, handful of memories from then that really sticks in my mind is when we had to, you know, choose the name. And, you know, we back then, you know, the way it worked was you went to a one of the large lecture halls prior to qualifications to draw your time to do qualifications. And when we drew the time, that was the last moment at which we could choose the name. And when I drew the time, they said, okay, you get, what's the team? And everyone knew us, of course, from our experience with Delta Chi. And I said, the team, we're the Cutters. And there was quite a bit of laughter from the room. I guess they underestimated our chances, which was a mistake. So
that was my question, going back to my question of what was the perception of the race organization and the other racers of your team. They didn't expect you guys to do what you did that first year.
I think they expected us to be competitive, just given the pedigree of the program and of two riders that were on the team, Randy Strong and Scott Sinise, both of whom actually rode in the Little 500 in 1982. And that team got second. And then, of course, they knew from, you know, again, the history of the program that we had been successful in the past. So I don't think that they, you know, viewed the team as a win for sure, but certainly one of the better teams. And I got to be quite honest with you, not having the, you know, the support of the fraternity system, you know, it's a big advantage, you know, to have the people involved to help, you know, with the race on race day, with training schedules. You know, it's a pool of people to draw riders from, if nothing else. So I think they that in part played into the math that said we probably wouldn't win for sure.
Well, let's talk about your cycling pedigree, as it were. Before, when you came to IU, did you have bike racing experience? Were you an enthusiast? You know, what was your bike experience?
I did not. I, you know, played the traditional sports in high school, basketball, football, baseball. I really wasn't even aware of cycling as a sport. I mean, I knew it was one, but no one I knew, really did it, or really participated in it. And when I got to IU, I joined the Delta Chi fraternity, which had a history of success in the race, as we've said. But, you know, that was really, you know, secondary. I didn't really know that much about it. But I became good friends with, at the time, Chris Gutowski, who was a member of a number of Delta Chi winning teams. He was a, you know, I think they had categories back then. He was a category one racer, at the time. And so I became good friends with him, and he really sort of, once I got interested in the sport, really helped teach me everything that I know about the sport today. And it was in fact that loss that he and the team suffered in 1982 that in part, sort of inspired me to take up the sport in seriously.
When you won the race in 84, what year were you?
I was a junior. So I was, junior. I had 1 year to go.
Yep. Okay. And of course, after, as you and I have known each other for a long time and raced together against and with.
Yes.
Cooperatively, yes. And antagonistically. You went on to race and still do at a real high level. You raced pro or semi-pro on the track in Europe. And I mean, it was a springboard for you, as it has been for lots of other people.
Yeah. I mean, it really was. I found the sport. I was lucky. I consider myself lucky. I found a sport that I can, I was good at, had some success and can continue to do. And I do today. It really is a big part of my life now, in general, all going back to really to that day in 1984.
I can count on contemporary riders now. Eric Young is a pro with Rally. He started racing in Little Five. The Stetnas came through the Little 500, program. I know I'm missing some big ones, but there's so many people who got their start at the Little Five racing bikes who went on to a high level.
Yeah. It's just a terrific event. I learned so much about, how to win, how to be successful, how to plan, how to deal with adversity, how to deal with success, from that race. It really was a great experience for me.
Well, it is a terrific event, but it's not your typical bike race. And now through the lens of you going on to do air quote real bike racing, I struggle sometimes to describe it to people. How do you describe the Little 500?
First of all, I always try and tell people, it helps if you've seen the movie Breaking Away, because there is, obviously a lot of, footage of the race, in that movie, and you get a sense of how the race flows and what the strategies, are like. It is if you're familiar with bike racing, it is very similar to what's known as a Madison race on the track, and it is a type of relay where you have a teammate. In the case of Little 500, you have four teammates. There are three teammates, four on a team, and each of you basically takes turns riding in the race. The trick is the exchange, as we call it, a critical part of the race. You actually have to trade bikes or swap bikes while the race is proceeding. So like all bike races, that's one of the unique things about bike racing from other sports, is that it doesn't stop. There is no stoppage of play. If you fall behind, if you crash, the race goes on without you. And you're obviously free to catch up. But obviously no one is going to wait for you. So you have to make that exchange while the race is in progress. And then your man coming in has to reestablish his position in the race. It's held on a track, modeled loosely after the Indy 500, hence the name Little 500. And there's 200 laps on a roughly a quarter mile track. Cinder track. Yes. Yes. So it is unique in many ways. But at the end of the day, it's a bike race, and all of the dynamics and strategies that you would normally be familiar with in bike racing, in general, apply: drafting, sprinting, position, strategy, things of that nature.
You're a tall rider. Were there any other tall riders on your team, or did you have to do bike exchanges or rider exchanges? I guess they're called.
You know, like so many other things in life, you know, timing and luck plays a part. And I was fortunate enough on that first team that there were all four of us were tall. So sharing a bicycle was less of a concern. So we all rode basically the same seat height, and the bike was set up for all of us. So we were all, I think everybody on the team was at least 6'1". So that's that was an advantage for us.
Going into that first year, 1984 Cutters, what was your role on the team?
Well, I was, you know, that was my really, I mean, technically I was a rookie. I had never, you know, ridden in Little 500, and I had done a handful of, I think it was called USCF back then, US Cycling Federation races, you know, prior to that. But I was, you know, from in terms of experience, you know, true experience, I was probably quite inexperienced in that regard. But it's a long story, but on, again, back to the circumstances that led to us leaving the fraternity, my role was, I guess, you know, a leader of the band of misfits, I guess we'll call it, at that point, again, given the exit from the fraternity.
On race day, was it the plan to have you on the bike at the end?
Yeah, and that's you know, that was one of the things that you know, that made the experience in general, you know, so overall great for me, was that, you know, we planned that race, and we still do. Our team still does, just like so many other things that we do in life. I mean, we planned it to almost to the lap, and yeah, the plan was for me to ride the last set of the race, and then compete in the sprint. I you know, you never quite know what is going to happen. We did not plan to have a sprint at the end of the race, but you know, sometimes it works out that way. Obviously it worked out. So
12 out of, you know, the Cutters have won 12 times since 1984. So it does work out, and it works out often. And you know, you called the program, that I still see happening today. And that program is very organized and well run. That can't be the only attribute to the success, though. I sometimes have trouble trying to explain how the Cutters do it year after year. What do you think the secret to the success is?
You know, I must admit, every time I go back, I kind of, you know, think about that question a little bit too. I'll be honest with you. When we started the team, we did not intend to have, a lasting program. Typical, you know, college kids. I mean, we were living in the moment, you know, for the moment. We weren't, you know, didn't have an idea that there would be a surviving team, a team called the Cutters would still be around after 34 years, 33 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but I think a lot of it just goes back to, you know, the, obviously that first win was huge. If we don't win that first race, I don't think there's a team, you know, after that, quite honestly. Maybe not, but certainly getting that first win, in the fashion that it occurred, with everyone knowing the story about the, you know, the exit from the fraternity, I think it established, you know, the team as, you know, something that other people wanted to be a part of, right?
Well, so success. Let me interrupt you just one second. Yeah. So the thread that I see, I think I'm answering my own question, but after hearing you explain it, but the the thread, I think, is attitude and confidence, because that first year, you didn't have the organization. You had some organization from the old team, but you guys were running on confidence and just attitude. And now you have everything else in the Cutter program, the organization, but you still have that aggressive attitude that, you know, you go into the race expecting to win.
Yeah. Because if you go in expecting less, obviously you won't have any trouble meeting that goal. That's for sure. A couple of the people that were, you know, involved in the program back in the day, you remember them telling me, really the key is, you know, you have to do all this preparation. And it's, you know, a big part of it is mental, a big part of it is physical, but at the end of the day, it comes down to, you know, whoever walks into that stadium and says, you know, I did not come here to lose. You know, those are the guys, those are the teams that are probably going to win the race. So attitude was a tremendous part of our ethos from the very, very beginning. And I think you described it when we first started talking about it, sort of giving the finger, I think, to many that had slighted us over the years was a big part of it. So, some revenge, you know, I guess as part of it. Mm-hmm. But you know, that the teams today, they don't know. I mean, they don't know all that. I mean, they know the story of the program a little bit. But I think what's made the team successful, over the years, you know, has been, you know, the continued involvement, you know, from people that were a part of the team as riders, and then are a part of the team as staff and management, so to speak. And, you know, we are a team that we tend not to make the same mistakes twice, right? We study the race, the guys do it today, we did it back then, and we took it, you know, very seriously and tried to approach it professionally, in terms of preparation, insofar as that's possible, you know, when you're a group of undergraduate college kids. And I think people are drawn to the opportunity to be a part of something that is bigger than them. And that was a big, big part of the experience, for me later, you know, being involved with the team was, you know, hey, we've got something here that's pretty special, and it makes a difference in people's, you know, college experience and how they turn out to be, as adults. At least it did for me. So that kind of thing attracts quality people. And the program has, you know, continued to do that. I mean, it really is amazing, the success that they've had over the years. I mean, I think just before we started the call, I started to try and think about, okay, how many races have there been, and, you know, how many have we won? And I think since the race started, we've won about a third of the races. But if you do the math from the first Delta Chi victory, I think we've won almost 45% of the races. Any sports dynasty has its, common threads and things of that nature. And, you know, sort of ours is no different, I don't think.
Well, let's talk about your 1984 race day. Can you describe, not lap by lap, but in an abridged format, what happened the day of the race? What were the conditions? You know, what happened?
Well, nothing is easy. The race was actually delayed one day by weather. So it was supposed to go on Saturday, the 20th or 21st. It's usually always around that particular part of April. It rained all day on Saturday, and they postponed the race till Sunday.
When were you ready? Were you ready to race on Saturday? And then when did you find out it wasn't going to happen?
You know, we never went to the track on Saturday. So we never, the race had been called, well before that. because it was clear it was going to rain all day. And I should say that the race has been run in the rain, but you know, this was a, you know, pretty big storm, a lot of wind, a lot of rain, as is typical in Indiana that time of year. So it was postponed a day, which, you know, I suppose looking back on it, you know, we were ready to race and, it didn't really affect us, you know, that much. So, you know, we had to, you know, sort of get geared up, you know, one more time for the race the very next day. The day of the race, the Sunday, it was Easter Sunday, actually, I think, coincidentally, the weather wasn't good. It was windy. It wasn't rainy, but it was really gray and cold and overcast. So conditions weren't great, but you know, you're a bike racer, you know, if you're fit and ready, it doesn't matter, you know, what the conditions are. You know, we didn't care. We were there to race and, you know, we were going to win no matter what. But the race went, you know, relatively smooth. You know, we had no crashes. We qualified 10th, you know, we're able to establish our position early in the race, which is, you know, sort of the first goal is to get where you need to be safely, because the race is very chaotic at the start. It's a flying start with 33 teams on the track. But we did establish position early, and everything went off really sort of according to plan. One of our guys did have to ride, you know, a much, much longer set than anticipated late in the race, you know, really no incidents, so to speak of.
How long was that set, and why did they have to ride it?
The set turned out to be about 40 laps.
At consecutive?
Yeah. Wow. Consecutive. And that was because one of our other riders had a cramp and had to, you know, get some treatment, you know, stretch his legs, and, you know, just wasn't ready to go when the time came. So Adam Beck ended up riding that that long set in the middle, and we were ready for that. You know, part of being prepared is, you know, thinking of all the scenarios that you know, may come up, and you know, because we had, you know, done all the training and all the preparation work, it was you know, sort of really no problem. I did end up getting on the bike a little bit later than we had originally planned, and again, that was just due to circumstances. Our coach at the time liked to put me on at the very, you know, as late as possible in the race, which made me really, really nervous, right? Because it was, you know, at that point in time, there's a lot going on, and but it all worked out. And
when you got on the bike that for that last time, how long had it been since you'd been out there? And as you said, you're nervous. I mean, what are you doing waiting for that last, you know, stage?
Yeah. So I think I rode my last lap before the final set. It was probably around 130 laps of the 200 lap race complete. So I hadn't touched the bike in, you know, probably 30 minutes.
But you're sitting on a trainer in the pit?
Sitting on a trainer. And back then they didn't have trainers. We were sitting on these old Schwinn Aerodyne exercise bicycles. This was pre turbo trainers. So we were on these, I was just sitting in the pits, you know, with my coat on, trying to stay warm. And then, you know, really just sort of thinking about, okay, you know, who's still left in the race, making sure that, you know, I'd had something to drink. It's a short race. You really don't need any food. The key part was staying warm and getting warmed up, ready to go, you know, when you get on the bike, because I got on with like four or five laps to go. I mean, the sprint is going right at that point. You're not, there's no time to warm up and settle in and find your legs.
So, yeah, you're getting from standing to on a bike and full gas.
And full gas, yes, exactly. So I got on the bike okay. My teammate Randy Strong did a great job avoiding some accidents and carnage, towards the end of the race to do a clean exchange, so we could do a clean exchange. And if you've never seen the race, that, you know, that last series of exchanges is, it's super exciting. As everyone struggles to get their final guy on. So I'd highly recommend, seeing that if you ever get the chance. But I got on in good shape and got to the front where I needed to be. At the time, every team that we were worried about was still on the lead lap.
And how many teams was that?
11. 11 of the 33. So, that's a pretty complicated sprint on the track. I mentioned a few things, the picking of the name and certain things stand out in your mind over the years. And I remember our coach at the time, who was, one of the founders of the original program. I was a very inexperienced bike racer at the time. But I was, among the group that we had that year, I was clearly the strongest. But I didn't have the sprint experience or the tactical know-how at the time. I was winning, and I had won a race before the Little Five, a USCF race, and the limited success I'd had up until that time, I was getting it on just raw strength, and sort of attitude. There was no tactic involved. And a Little Five sprint, like any sprint on the road or the track, it can be complicated. And there were a handful of guys in the Little Five that year that were, accomplished USCF racers. The main threat was an Acacia rider who had won the race before, in spectacular fashion, was a really smart rider. And so my coach had said, okay, look, here's how you're going to ride it. We want you to lead the final lap. We don't think anyone can pass you, once you do take the lead, but you have to get the lead, right? I never forget this. He said, the one thing we don't want to have happen is we don't want you to get passed anytime after the last lap starts, which sounds like, really basic advice. But it's hard to make that happen. Right. And I was, sitting, sort of, I was second or third wheel coming to the finish line with the white flag out. And, I made a mistake. I let the speed get a little too low on that last start of the last lap, or, with a lap and a half to go. And the riders behind, who had a ton of momentum, flew over the top of me, with one to go with the white flag showing. And there was a chain of three riders that passed me right at the start finish line.
With the bell ringing.
With the bell ringing, yeah. And keep in mind, these bikes are, it's a 69-inch gear. So you to get that bike accelerated is pretty simple, but closing a gap, with that kind of a gear can be really, really problematic. I was also, I was so inexperienced at the time. My wheel was overlapped on the inside of the rider that was in front of me at the start of the bell lap. So I was almost pinned as Jeff Hilligoss, Jim Pollock, and there's another name if you're a bike racing fan, Jim Pollock, a Olympic team member. I forget who the other rider was, But those, I think it was a Fiji. Of course, it had to be a Fiji. It's always the Fijis. They came over the top, you know, established a gap. I was able to get my wheel on the right side of the rider in front of me, and I just caught on to their train. Going into the first corner with one lap to go, and I got to be honest with you, from that point forward, I don't really remember a whole lot about what I did or, you know, what exactly happened. I remember, as I said, making the mistake with one to go. I remember just barely catching the train. And at the time, you know, even before that, it was going so hard. I was thinking, oh my God, I don't think I'm going to make it, because you get on the bike with, you know, no warm up. And like you said, you're going full gas. But once I got onto the train with about a lap to go, I don't really remember a whole lot about what exactly happened, except for as we go into the third and fourth turns, I thought, okay, I'm still fourth, and that's a long way to make up with, you know, really no time to speak of. And I thought, okay, you're going to have to take a chance that something works out. And I remember I thought, okay, I'm just going to come up the inside. I'm going to push whoever I need to out of the way. And, you know, either I'm coming through or we're crashing. And fortunately, what happened was once I committed, and I must say, once I caught on to the train, I got a really nice toe through the third and fourth turns. And I soft pedaled through those turns, right? So as we exited the fourth turn, I had chain slack, as they say, right? So there was still gear left,
yeah,
you know, to accelerate. And Jeff Hillegas was leading the sprint out, and Jim Pollock was second, who started to come around him.
To the right or left?
To the right. So Jim is coming over the right in classic sprint style. And Jeff, also in classic style, starts to drift just a little bit to the right. And that was my opportunity, right?
The heavens opened up.
Right, exactly. And so I came straight through that gap. And the very next thing I remember seeing after the start of that first lap, after the start of that last lap, was I had been buried for so long in that last set that all of a sudden, as Hillegas moved over just a little bit to the right, there's like clear runway.
Uh-huh.
And the way the stadium is built, it's a big grandstand on the right-hand side, and everybody from the infield, of course, had, you know, piled in or crowded toward the finish line, because this is going to be a big sprint, right? The race hadn't seen a big, you know, a big 11-up sprint in a long, long time. So as that, you know, the heavens parted, as you said, or the roadway opened up, you know, there's just this wall of people, you know, crowded onto both sides of the track. And I'll never forget, you know, seeing that opening, and, you know, the view of the finish line and nobody in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I had all the speed, and, you know, and it was, I even had time to get my hands up before the finish line.
Yeah. It wasn't close. I mean, you came through, timed it perfectly, and came through on the inside.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I'll remember that forever. Of course,
it is an iconic finish. I wasn't there at the race, but I've watched it on video a number of times. And that picture of you winning, the IU Student Foundation uses it a lot. And I think we saw it on a T-shirt last year. And I said that you should go ask the person for money. But it was a classic victory. And even though you don't remember it, you wrote it. Except not leading into that last lap, you wrote it very well, it worked out. After the celebration must have been incredible. After,
yeah, I mean, I think it did so. I mean, this is self-serving. I think it really did a lot for the race too, right? It, you know, a team calling itself the Cutters, you know, beat the fraternity teams. I think they, you know, the foundation benefited tremendously from. from a different result, a team that was connected to the movie winning, the close finish with all the teams on the same lap, et cetera, I think was a really, it was a lot of fun. And like you say, they point to that victory, in a lot of their advertising and a lot of their imagery over the years.
That race also, I know that teams do they study and they watch films and watch video. And I know teams watch that year in particular just to, that was not a unique finish. I didn't realize that it was the first kind of mass sprint finish in many years.
Yeah. And it is one of the things you ask about, how does a team, stay at such a high level? I mean, we did a lot of things that other teams, do today and take for granted, like the films, right? We used to watch film all the time. We were sort of obsessed with the race, and in part, I think you do have to be obsessed with, like anything in life, there has to be a level of commitment, to study the race, to see what's happened, to plan accordingly and use the tools that are available. We used to get the old heavy video cameras out and videotape practice, and then we'd go back and, watch those films. The race has come a long way, over the years, but at the end of the day, it's still a bike race, and all the sort of the rules and skills, haven't really changed that much over the years. Yeah, the technology is different, but, the strategies and the techniques, they're all pretty much the same.
Well, the bike technology is the same. The gear is the same. The bikes, that's what I appreciate about the race, is it's sort of like baseball. I mean, the race bike has pretty much stayed the same since the 60s, I would say. It's the same bike.
Yeah, and that, that part of that is, I think, it's what makes the race unique. It's a coaster brake bike. It probably, I don't know, what do you think it weighs? Probably.
I think they have to weigh, I can't remember. It's in the 20s, but there's a weight. Yeah. There's a weight minimum.
By the standards of the bikes we ride today, right?
I think it's like a 24 pound bike, 25.
Yeah, that's pretty heavy. Mm-hmm. No gears, single piece crank, right? If you can remember that.
Right. I think you're holding your finger over your microphone on your laptop. There you go.
Part of it that makes it interesting, like I said, is the bike is the same, right? And it's the same for everyone, right? So in a certain sense, it is down to the ability and the skill of the rider. There's no technological advantage, so to speak, insofar as one is even possible.
Okay, Adam Giles, winner of the 1984. Indiana University Little 500, and you're in the Hall of Fame, the Little 500 Hall of Fame, correct?
Actually, I'm not.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'm gonna nominate you this year.
That's okay. My experience was great, nonetheless.
Okay, Adam, thanks for being on the podcast, and go Cutters.
My pleasure. Go Cutters.
We have a rookie rider from the Little 500 this year, Will Hobart, joining us on the podcast today. Hello, Will.
How's it going?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Doing well.
Will, is you are 1 week away. Well,
yes.
I guess less than
Six
a week
days.
Away.
Yeah.
From the Little 500. It's next Saturday. How are you feeling this morning?
I'm feeling great this morning. Legs feel good. I had an off day yesterday. So, yeah, definitely very excited for the upcoming week. A little nervous as it is my first race, but, yeah, definitely really excited.
It's your first Little 500, so you're classified as a rookie.
Mm-hmm.
How unusual is it to be a rookie in the race? Do you know how many first-year riders there are?
I'm not exactly sure how many first-year riders there are, but it is pretty rare to be a rookie in the race, especially on a well-established team. I ride for CSF Cycling, and we started riding in the race in 2011. So we kind of have 7 years of experience bringing in riders, getting that knowledge. So when you come into a team that's well-established, honestly, we're kind of new comparatively to some other teams. But when you come into an established team, there's usually older guys. So as a rookie, it's a little tough to get in that race lineup.
For the uninitiated, let's explain a few things. The race, the Little 500, has been going on since 1951. In the beginning, it was just Greek teams, you know, fraternities and housing units too.
Yeah.
And then sometime in the past, they started to allow what are called independent teams to ride in the race. And
yeah.
You're on one of those called CSF. What is that team?
It's Christian Student Fellowship. So that's a ministry here on campus. We also have a house that I actually live in. We have a bike room there. And we race in the Little 500.
And the team's been in the race for 7 years?
Yes, been in the race for 7 years. We've qualified, our top qualification is third, and then our top finish in the race was 14th last year.
So this is it's a house and a group of guys who live together on campus at IU.
Yes, actually. So as long as you're a part of the kind of the ministry, the organization as a whole, you can be on the team. So I'm actually the only rider on the team that actually lives in the house. But I've liked it a lot because my room is two doors down from the bike room. So I'm able to take a few steps out of my room and go right into a workout.
Why does CSF want to have a Little 500 team? What's the goal of doing that?
Yeah, so the big thing as a team that we want to do is, I guess first our goal is to be fast and do well on the track. And then the second more important goal is just to be a ministry out there, shining our light, bringing people to the house, inviting them to dinner, and just trying to have a positive impact on the Little 500 community.
Cool. Okay. Seventh year, as we said, you're a rookie, and you are on the team and will ride in the race. How does that selection process work? When did you find out you were going to be on the team? How many people were going for those spots?
Yeah. So it's an interesting process, and I think it's different for every team. So I guess starting in the fall, when we started going on rides and starting getting into our training plan, the evaluation started. So at that point, there was a lot of guys that were coming out trying to be on the team. We were going on rides, doing different workouts, and kind of the evaluation started there, like to see baseline where you were. Throughout the fall and into the spring, we do a lot of different events, like individual time trials, missing out, team pursuit. And through a lot of those different events and races, our team was basically able to identify who would be in the race. And honestly, there's two veterans that are seniors that are really, really solid riders on our team. So they were basically shoe-ins. I kind of separated as the third guy fairly early. And then recently, within the past few weeks, we've had to decide between two. So from a pool of five, and we were really deciding on that fourth guy up until recently.
Is it a collective decision? Do you have a coach who makes
it? So we have a few coaches, a student coach, and our captain was involved to make that decision, kind of a collective effort on their part. I wasn't really a part of it, but definitely excited for the four guys we have for the race.
You must have an alternate in case something happens.
Yes, in case something crazy happens this week. Hopefully it doesn't, but yeah, there's someone ready.
The format of the race is that it is somewhat formatted after the Indianapolis 500.
Mm-hmm.
In that teams have a pit around a track. Every team has to have at least three riders. Your team has
Sammy four. Did it with two last year.
Pardon me?
Sammy did it with two last year. So you can do it with two riders. There just needs to be a certain number of exchanges throughout the race.
10, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay. But your team has four riders.
Yeah.
And the teams and the race is 200 laps long on a quarter mile track, so 50 miles.
Mm-hmm.
You have all sorts of events before the race next Saturday that give you experience, and also the most important one is the one that determines your pit position.
Yes,
and quals. And explain how qualifications worked.
Yeah, so quals, every team has a specific track time, and that's decided. There's a big meeting, and they draw names out of a hat, so it's pretty random. It's a pretty fun event because all the guys and girls teams are there. And then people attempt to trade for a better spot, which usually doesn't work well.
Better? What would be a better or worse spot?
There's some strategy behind it. Some teams like to be earlier in the day, later this year. Or there's also times where they roll the track. And rolling the track, meaning since it's a cinder track, it can get kind of dusty, or there can develop different types of ruts in the track, which make it a little more sketchy to ride on. So after they roll it, immediately after, usually you have a smooth surface. So some teams like to be right there. This year, the big consideration was the weather and kind of trying to time up a time when you can be out there and the weather was good, which was hard to predict this year. But overall qualifications, once you get that time, then your team has to do four laps around the track and exchange after every lap. So most teams do it with four riders. And so each rider does one lap, exchanges, gets off the bike, hands it to the next guy. And then once those four laps are done, they stack up everyone's times. And then your time determines where you start in the race, the pit position, as you mentioned, the jersey you're wearing in the race, and then actually if you get in the race, because you have to be in the top 33 times to get into the race as a team.
And what position did CSF qualify?
So we qualified in the 25th position, which historically is not great for our team. It was really an interesting Saturday on the day of quals in that the weather was really unpredictable. Early on in the day, we went at 11 a.m. We went when there was standing water and ice on the track, so we couldn't take the turns tight. and it was also hailing slash sleeting as we were going. So the sleet was hitting your face and stinging, and the one lap even just hurt a lot. So it was a tough qual for us. But it was really interesting because of that fluctuation in the weather. There's a lot of historically good teams spread throughout the race. Usually you can look at the top 15 in quals and say, okay, those are our solid teams. They can really go for the race and go for the win. But this year, it's really interesting. There's a lot of teams spread throughout. So right around us, we have Beta, we have 3PH, and Grave Goat that are a lot further back than they normally would be.
So based on your qual position, you then get to select what pit you are around this oval quarter-mile cinder track. And that also determines where you line up on the starting grid.
Yep.
For the parade laps. You've never raced the race.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably watched a lot of video of the race.
Yeah.
I assume you do. You know how mechanically how the race starts and how it works. Explain how it lines up and how the race physically starts.
Yeah, absolutely. So how it starts is there's 33 teams in the race, and similar to an Indy 500, so it's kind of modeled after that. We'll start with 11 rows. So there's three people within each row, and they will start with three parade laps. So they'll have a pace car come out, everyone will line up in their rows, and they'll start with some slow laps on the last one, slowly kind of get up to race speed. But as they're doing these parade laps, the rows have to keep, I think it's a full bike length or two full bike lengths in between each other. So you keep that space. You can get a penalty for kind of creeping up on the line in front of you. And then once they throw the green flag, everyone goes and they go hard. Everyone sprints at the start because they want to avoid a lot of the wrecks, because everyone's together at the start. And that means that there's teams in there that are a little sketchy, and wrecks happen. A wreck happened in the first lap of the race last year.
I'm not very good at math, so tell me what row you're going to be in for the start.
So we will be in the eighth row.
That's good. I'm glad you could calculate that quickly. Yeah. This early in the morning.
Yeah, it's... So we'll be on the eighth row on the inside, which is honestly not great, because you'd like to be on the outside so you can make a nice move up to the front. But we're going to have to hang around on the inside, try and advance on the inside. So it'll be a little interesting for our starting guy.
At this point, you know the other teams quite well, because you've been doing, especially as a rookie, you've been putting in a lot of track time at the track at Bill Armstrong mm-hmm. Stadium, with all these different training sessions, but also with events. What are some of the events you've done leading up to this?
Yeah, so in the fall I did ITTs, which is individual time trials. We actually did a cyclocross event. And then we had Missing Out and street sprints in the fall. And then coming into the spring, we've had quals, we've had team pursuit, another round of ITTs, individual time trials, and then Missing Out in the spring as well.
So you get a real sense about the other riders and the other teams, who you want to be around, who you don't want to be around biking.
Yeah, exactly. You definitely get to know the other teams. And kind of know what a good wheel to be on is, because there's definitely teams that you know probably will be going down. You don't want to be around them. But, yeah, definitely kind of get a sense for who's strong on the track, all of that sort of thing.
Are rookies required to do more track time, to put in more track time than veterans?
Yes, there's different requirements for rookies. There's rookie week in the spring where it's kind of like a crash course on, you know, pack riding on the track, pace line.
No pun intended, crash course.
Yeah, I actually crashed during one of my skills sessions for rookie requirements. So exactly. But so it kind of gives you a sense of like being comfortable on the track, teaching you the skills that you need, like jumping on and off the bike, and kind of making sure that the rookies are safe on the track.
Well, let's talk about the bike a little bit before I ask my next question. Describe a little 500 bike, and where do they come from? What are the bikes? How many bikes does the team have?
Yeah, absolutely. So the little 500 bikes, right now they're Schwinn. They've been different companies in the past, but they're Schwinn bikes. They're single speed. And basically these bikes are an equalizer because every team has to use the same bike. They have to use it at the same, speed. And then there's certain, kind of rules on what you can modify on the bike. So you can modify the wheels, the saddle, the stem, the handlebars, the pedals, but the pedals cannot be clip in. That you cannot clip in any way, but so that's basically the bike, and they come from Schwinn. We order them through IUSF, and each team gets two bikes per year because you can use two bikes in the race.
So you have to race on the bikes that are issued to you, but your house CSF has a stable of bikes from previous years that you use to train on.
Yeah. Exactly. So we have a lot of different bikes that we've been able to build out. Usually we use like the stock parts that we get with them to use on our training bikes. So throughout the fall and spring, we can ride on these bikes without worrying. Like we just got our race bikes a few weeks back. And really the bottom bracket can get really gritty on the cinder track. So we don't really use them at all leading up to the race. Just to keep them fresh and make sure they're all clean and ready to go for race day.
The gear is a 46-18 for the bike nerds out there, which is quite a small gear.
Yes.
So training, you put in a lot of track time. You do individual time trial, missing out, team pursuit, all on this 46-18 gear, which requires you to spin a very, very high cadence to go at race speed. Is a lot of your training centered around that high cadence?
Yeah, so I'd say there's two main components to our training plan when we're thinking about like focused intervals that are working at something specific. So first would be kind of power and power generation. And that's, you know, different intervals focus on that. And then the other part is, for me, I've never been a competitive cyclist. When I started on the road bike, I think you probably remember, I was trying to grind, go real in a big gear, kind of go slow cadence. So that's what felt natural to me. So the other thing that we've been working on in interval training is, you know, that high cadence work and getting comfortable with getting in that, being in that low gear and going on a high cadence and not bouncing on the seat. Cause that's something that, you know, at the start, it's hard to control, which is bad on the cinder track, especially when you're going on the turns. If you're bouncing on the seat, you're going to be going down. We've done a lot of work with that high cadence on the rollers, because really you do need to get up, because race, it's an average of 120 RPMs. If you're sprinting, you're going to have to get up to 150 plus RPMs. So you definitely have to get used to spinning quickly, which is not something that's really natural at the start.
Right. The race is 50 miles long, and even with on this bike with a single speed, no toe clips, no clips, spinning your 4618 gear at 120 RPMs, the average speed is still 23, 24 miles an hour, which is, yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really quick. But yeah, definitely in the pack makes it a lot easier to maintain that speed throughout.
The bikes also are coaster brakes. It's a track bike in that there's no handbrakes, but it's not a fixed gear. It's a coaster brake.
Yeah, and that kind of comes into play when we hop off the bike, because we use that coaster brake. We slam down on the back of it and kind of use it to swing our legs around and jump off the bike. So yeah, that's where that kind of comes into play. We skid in to bring the bike into the next person.
But if you have two bikes, why do you need to get off the bike? Why not do a rider exchange? Why do a bike exchange?
There's a few different strategies there. We have three guys that are about the same height, including me, and it's our top three guys. So we're going to be doing a lot of exchanges where we're not bringing in a new bike. We're just using the same bike. And the big thing there is that when you're doing a bike to bike, which is when you switch bikes, the person has to stand there with the new bike until they're able to tag you. So basically, you're going to have to come to a complete stop. They're at a complete stop, and then they're going to have to get up to speed by running the bike and then jumping on. But when you're doing a rider exchange, when you're passing on the same bike, there's not that stop. You're able to come into the guy, skid, and pass the bike while you're both running, basically. So there's none of that lost momentum. So you're able to get a quicker exchange and get into the pack quicker.
That skill to do it correctly requires a lot of practice, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. We practiced a lot. We've been practicing a lot in the spring. Basically every track practice when we're there will end in just a little bit of exchange work. And we did a lot of practice leading up to quals, because that's such an integral part of quals. Because if you fall a couple times in quals, then you're out of the race. So those exchanges and quals are very important. So over spring break, we were here on the track working on exchanges all day, all the time. So
you said fault. Explain what that means.
Yeah. So in quals and then in the race as well, the exchange has to happen within two pit lengths, and they're watching that very closely in quals. So if the person that's getting on the bike grabs the bike too early, or the person getting off of the bike doesn't get off quick enough, also if you drop the bike, if the handlebars hit the ground in quals, that's a fault. In the race, you're fine, but you're going to lose the pack if you do that. So that's what a fault is.
You can also be penalized in the race, much like as it is patterned out after the Little 500, with all sorts of penalties. And there are flags around, stewards with flags around the track, yellow, green, black, red, all that stuff. How prepped are you? You are prepped, but explain the flag system.
Yeah, so definitely prepped on what the different flags mean. The big ones are, you know, green, start of the race, yellow. They use a lot when there's a wreck on the track, and they need everyone to, they kind of have to help people clear the bikes off the track and then also help people get the medical attention they need. And then white flag, final lap, and then hopefully you see that checkered flag on the last lap. But yeah, there's also some other laps that tell lapped riders to move out of the way of the main pack that are on the lead lap. A few different race penalties. But those race penalties are really, really killer, because you have to literally go into a penalty box, stop your bike, and they, you know, count off the timer, and then you can go back in the race. But that can be really tough, because the just part of the race is that if you lose that lead pack, it's really, really hard to get back into the race. So the main penalties that you see within Little Five are usually impeding, which is when basically, as a rule of thumb, you have to hold your line. If you move off your line, make a move, and it causes someone to change their direction, wreck, hit their brakes, slow down, that's impeding. And that's probably the most common one that you see in Little Five.
You also see creeping under yellow
when
there's a crash and that yellow flag is out. You're supposed to hold your position relative to the leader, so not mm-hmm. advance. Race day, let's talk about your final preparation. This week, you know you're on probably a rest week with some leg openers midweek. And then leading up to the race Saturday, what do your Friday and Saturday look like?
Yeah, so Friday we're going to be doing a little spin on the rollers on the Little Five bikes, with a few spin ups just to get the legs moving. Nothing too crazy or strenuous. And then 4 p.m. on Friday we're going to head over to the girls' race. So CSF also has a women's Little 500 team, so we'll be going out there supporting them. We'll be being sure to stay hydrated, stay out of the sun on that day. And then after that, probably we'll be getting dinner with the team, carbo loading, and then getting some rest the night before. So our race is at 2 on Saturday, so I'll probably get up pretty early, try and get a fairly good-sized breakfast in, so I can get some food for the day. I know for me, the closer I'll get to the race, the less I'll want to eat, so I'm going to have to eat a lot early with nerves and everything. And then just being here in the bike room with the team, getting ready, getting over to the track, which is not too far from here, and then just getting ready to go for the race. Yeah, I'm excited. Definitely a little nervous now talking about it, but
without giving away the team's strategy, of course, specifics, can you talk us through kind of the plan for your race and specifically your role on the race as a member of a four-man team?
Yeah, absolutely. So my role specifically, I'm kind of the three guy. I'm not going to be our sprinter or anything like that we want to put in at the end of the race. So my job basically is throughout the 200 laps to eat up as many laps as I can, so that our one and two guy, and our one guy being our sprinter, can kind of save their energy. We like to use the term like matches, the analogy, because once you burn your matches, if they're in the race for a bunch of laps at the start of the race, they're not going to have matches to burn at the end when we need them to sprint in the last lap. So my role throughout the race will be eating up laps, being in the race for as long as I can, so that they're off the bike and they're ready for the end. So getting them to the end while staying on that lead lap and the lead pack is kind of where my head is at. And then the other part of that is, as a rookie, my first year in the race, I've never really cycled competitively before this. I'm not the guy that's going to be pushing the pace, pulling the pack to some sort of blistering pace. So my role in the race is to kind of ride smart, because I'm not going to be the person that's going to, you know, blow everyone away with my power or my speed or anything. So riding smart for me means finding a wheel, being on a wheel, and drafting all the time, tucking in behind someone. Because if I ride smart and I'm drafting throughout the race, that can be the difference between me doing, you know, 30 to 40 laps in the race and doing, you know, 50 or 60 laps, which is a big deal for kind of our guys at the end of the race.
How many laps will you do in a set? How many laps will you be out there at a stretch?
So it kind of depends on the situation and what we're going for. Standard, I want to be out there for 10 to 12 laps. The big thing is I want to be able to, it doesn't matter how many laps I'm in if I can't burn at the end. And burning is kind of like a sprint at the end of your set, so that you can get separation from the main pack, get separation from the field, so that you have that time to exchange, because the exchange will slow down your team a little bit. So you kind of build in that separation at the end of your set so that the person getting onto the bike can integrate back into the main pack. So that's the big thing when I'm looking at a set. I'd like to do 10 to 12, but if it's hot, if it's fast and there's some fast laps, people are trying to pull away, people are burning, maybe I'm doing a 6-lap set. It's just depending on the situation and making sure that I can get the next guy in the right position.
Well, it's a lot to keep track of. And when you're out there redlining with, you know, bleeding out of your eyeballs, whose decision is it? And how do you communicate? You're passing your pit every, you know, less than every minute.
Yeah.
What's the communication system from you to the pit or from the pit to you?
Yeah, so on my end as the rider, my communication will, a lot of teams will pull their hand off the handlebars and like make some signal with their head, like tapping their head or something. We don't do that just because it's so easy to wreck like that, and it's just not really safe. So we hold our fingers.
Well, I don't want you to give away your pit signals. No. If other teams are going to, you know, it's like stealing signs in baseball, but you're using some hand signal with your hands on the bars.
Yeah, hand signals with our bar on the bars.
Uh-huh.
To communicate with the pit. And we kind of have like a group of alumni that have rode past coaches that will be along the fence. And then of course our coach will be there and the other riders. And they're able to kind of watch where our rider is at all times, and they're able to see those signals so that the whole team knows what's going on. And they can just the riders can just focus on, you know, getting in the race when they need to.
Mm-hmm.
And then the coach will also be watching, and will have a whiteboard and also have some signals that they're able to throw out to communicate. But a lot of it is just falling on the rider in the race and kind of their discretion. If they think there's some times where, you know, it will be quick for 2 laps. And if you can, you know, really push it and hold on, the pack will kind of come back together, and you can kind of recover then and then burn off. So it's all kind of dependent. We have, you know, we've gone through a lot of different race tape and strategy to get that instinct instilled in your head, so that you kind of know. And it's a little tough for me because I've never, you know, been in a race and been in that situation in the actual 500 race. But I'm getting there. We've had a few opportunities. They do a practice start to the race, and we actually had a practice race, this week. And that was 50 laps. So it's a little less, but you're able to get in there for a set and kind of get that feeling of what's going on with everyone around you.
You're a sophomore at Indiana University. Is your intention to continue on with Little Five junior and senior year?
Yes, absolutely. Honestly, I wish I started last year, my freshman year. It's been an amazing time working and, you know, working hard with my team, getting to know the guys on my team, and then competing as a team. So, yeah, definitely want to continue that into the next 2 years.
Excellent. Well, we will we'll be watching you next Saturday, Will, and hope you have a restful, safe, and healthy week. And we know you and CSF are going to do well next Saturday. What do your jerseys look like for those people who are going to watch the race on TV or the web or in person?
So our jerseys are purple with white stripes. But the big thing to look out for is we have neon yellow helmets, and we'll be wearing neon yellow socks. And that's something we started last year. The team started last year. And it makes it really easy for people on the online broadcast to see, easily identify who our team is if they're watching for us. And then also from like, you know, a mechanic and a coach perspective, it's very easy to spot out where we are on the track, and also easy to see, oh, they're not in the pack anymore. They must have been in that wreck.
Or you're off the front.
Yeah. So that's what to look out for.
Excellent. Well, we'll be watching Will Hobart from Indiana University, rookie little 500 rider with CSF. Good luck next week.
Thank you.
Two Johns podcast. Now we have Chris Gutowski. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, John.
And we have Chris on in this little 500 special edition because Chris was really at the very beginning of the Cutters organization. But before the Cutters, there was another team, a fraternity team that spawned the Cutters. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it was a group of people that were just really interested in winning Little 500, and they did that through a fraternity. And then as things sort of shifted politically, and a lot of the bike team people ended up moving out of the fraternity, a lot of the people who supported that winning effort with Delta Chi at the time when I rode, those people shifted and helped create the whole Cutter movement. So it was just a continued success wave, so to speak.
So you weren't a rider for the Cutters, correct?
That's absolutely correct. I was sort of one of the interim players. You know, I just finished racing Little Five when the whole thing kind of blew up and people moved out of the fraternity. And so I helped facilitate, along with a bunch of other people, the creation of a new team, but really around the same group of people who had, you know, created this whole successful movement in the first place.
And we've talked to Adam Giles, who was on that first Cutters team, and talked about the legacy and the success wave, I like that term, of the Cutters. And it's still what you just described still seems to be happening today. The riders from the previous regime help out the new riders and so on.
Yeah, it's a great, you know, anyone involved in sports, you know, helping out kids, whether it's, you know, Little League or whatever it is, you know, we'll understand the feeling. You know, the point is, you know, kids come into school and either they rode a little bit or they just get caught by the bug at school. And with a little help and coaching and a good foundation, they can make a lot of progress, have a great time, and contribute to this crazy sort of intramural event that's been going on, you know, what are we at, 60 years now?
It started in 51, so I'm not good at math. I'll let you do that one.
A lot of years.
Well, the Cutter success is, it can't be just interested in sports and a little coaching. The race has been won by the Cutters 12 times since 1984. It must be something other than training and advice.
Well, that's a good point, but it's not just training and advice. It's a continuity thing. I think a lot of people, this is waxing poetic on modern life, but they lose track of what sort of that infrastructure and continuity in people and the value in people and the knowledge they carry. And the organization, for just a little, a group wrapped around a collegiate event, there's been a lot of continuity. Or this knowledge that's been passed on, or the same people have been involved for years, and that's a wealth of knowledge. It's way more than most organizations have. The modern organizations don't value that, and it sounds sort of weird in the context of a little collegiate cycling event, but I think it's proof that of how important that is.
When you came to IU, were you a cyclist?
I was, but it's a great question, because one of the great things about the Cutters is how many non-cyclists they've taken and sort of helped become great riders. You know, mm-hmm. that I think probably the number one or, best rider to come out of Little 500 came through the Cutter program and never rode a bike before he started riding Little 500.
Eric Young. Right. You're talking about Eric Young, who's current pro with Rally. And there are an amazing number of riders who came through and continued on to national or international level cycling and still ride today. Going back to you and riding, did you come to Indiana because of the Little Five? Was that a reason?
Actually, not. It was more just sort of a legacy thing. My dad had gone to school there. My brother was in school there, and I was lucky to have several options. And it was just sort of, I was racing my bike and not paying attention, and just sort of ended up going to Indiana because all the other deadlines passed and random, but it had nothing to do with Little Five. And I was actually just planning on quitting riding my bike until I got sucked into the Little Five thing.
Huh? As you said, it's unusual for riders to come into Little Five with experience. And during your era, there were some rules. I'm not real clear on the specifics and timeline, but maybe you can fill it in, about limiting the level of rider who can compete in the Little Five. You can't be, obviously, a pro, but you can't be a one or a two, and that happened while you were there?
Yeah, the rules have shifted over time, so it is kind of confusing, and the sort of intellectual basis behind those rules is not very sound, so it's hard to follow, right? It's not a natural transition, from one set of rules to another. But at the time I rode, if you were in the USA Cycling categorization system, if you were a category one or two, you couldn't ride Little 500.
we should let people know Chris is at the airport on his way overseas.
I'm fleeing the country.
So were you not able to ride Little Five because of were you a two or a one at the time?
Well, I came in from racing, age group racing, as a junior when I started school. So the first year I rode Little 500, there was no issue with the rule. And then it was a question of what happened the following years. And the categorization system was really in a state of flux, and it was kind of strange. And I just basically appealed and didn't get in the 1 year when I was ineligible. And then the next year I reappealed and pushed a little harder. And was able to get in. They didn't actually change the rule then, but I was able to get in. And as time has gone by, I think the rules have become a little bit more rational.
Well, I think you can't be higher than a Category 3 currently.
Yeah, I honestly don't even know.
I think it's
a No, Eric Young was at a higher level than that.
I think after, and he waited until after he left to cat up to a 2. But my question would be, you having ridden the race a bunch of times and been to it a number of times, do you agree with that limiting the category? Is it supposed to make it fairer for everybody? Is it supposed to make it safer because the speed is reduced? Do you agree with having that lower category limit?
Well, there are several different arguments for why you would have a rule like that. I think the biggest one has always been that somehow it's unfair if someone, you know, races outside of a little 500 and they reach a certain level. It's unfair they can compete. But, you know, to me, it makes no sense at all. I played intramural basketball, which is similar in a lot of ways. Little 500 is an intramural event open to all full-time students. And I played against guys who played basketball since they were organized basketball since they were 6, right? And they played all the way through high school, and then they're in college, and they, you know, they're not good enough to play major college, but there they are in intramurals playing. You know, you have guys who dunk on you, right? And it doesn't make any difference, right? You play, you have fun, and you know, little 5 to me limiting, you know, anyone. The whole point is to encourage participation. So to me, any rule, you look at it from that perspective and it makes it easy to analyze. The whole point is you want more people to participate, and you better have a good reason for keeping them out. And just because someone has worked really hard to be better at something doesn't mean you should keep them out.
The first year you raced Little 5 was 1979?
1978.
1978. And then, of course, the next year in the summer, 1979, the movie Breaking Away came out. It was filmed in Bloomington, parts of it. And you were around for that.
Yeah, it was filmed. They did a lot of stuff in the summer, and then they continued into the fall semester. And so I wasn't around much. I didn't do, I don't think, any of the summer or late summer filming. But as we got into the school semester, I was around for all of that. And we're fortunate to have a friend in our group from the Delta Chi team who was the main liaison to the whole film on the technical side, the whole cycling side.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got us all deluxe extra jobs. We got paid double time.
And what, double time to do what?
To basically hang out all day long. And, you know, movies, they shoot for 5 minutes and then they plan the next shot for 4 hours. And so, you know, you hang out, you play Frisbee, drink beer, whatever. And we got to hang out with a bunch of the actors and actresses, and we were privileged to eat at the Chuck Wagon with them. And so it was an incredible experience. It was not.
You were more than just an extra in the film, too. You were in at least the racing scenes, and I think you even have a line in the film. Yes,
I don't have an official line. You might be able to. My mom might have been able to hear my voice or something. But we're all in our little group of people. We're all like fairly visible. A bunch of us were on the bad guy fraternity team. But, John, I'll tell you, the coolest thing we got to do is a good friend of mine, Bill, who I raced with, we got to sit down with Peter Yates and help script that whole race ending scene. I mean, we literally just sat down with him and chalkboarded it and said, this is the way, yes, that's how we thought we should do it.
Wow.
And
wow.
So that was fun.
Did it change the race and how your sport was perceived? I know it's a seminal moment for lots of cyclists. Many people started riding and racing because of the film. You are already racing. Did it change, you know, sort of your, were you all of a sudden big man on campus after the movie came out?
Big man on campus. Not sure what that means, but it took the, you know, the race had all this history. It had really solid crowds, you know, that were at the time were in the low, I think 20,000 range, for each event, you know, and people were paying, you know, back in the day, they were already paying, you know, $10-$12 a head. And then the movie just blew the whole thing up. And for a few years, the Little 500 was it was a massive event that drew people from all over the country.
Yeah, I remember
it was more like a Kentucky Derby or something. It was insane.
Yeah, it was. I think, I don't know if it was on Wide World of Sports, but it was one of those nationally televised events like that for at least a few years.
Yeah, the one, it was on network TV one year, and that happened to be the year that I finally got to ride the sprint for the team, and of course lost it by a hair. And so I had lots of friends calling me long distance to tell me how sorry they were for me.
Well, how many, you first rode it in 78 for Delta Chi, you continued with Delta Chi and finished, how many years did you race in the race?
So 4 years total, I set out 79, so 78, 80, 81, 82. And a lot of the guys I rode with left before my last year, so we kind of had more of a rookie team, and I tried to steward them towards victory. But as I said, we missed that by a few inches.
And then, of course, as we've already said, it rolled into the Cutter program. After Little Five, after Indiana University, you went on to race full-time or semi-full-time on the track mostly, or did you split your time between road and track?
Yeah, it was definitely a split. We raced at the time, I think everyone still does, you race whatever you can get to, and I did some stage racing. I did a couple races that were about 10 days long, you know, racing 100, 120 miles a day, that kind of thing. And then for major track stuff, we would, as we called it at the time, we'd sort of come down for it. You go base yourself at a track for a few weeks, do more specific workouts and get ready for some big competition, like a national championship or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of national championships, of course, we have to mention that you did win the Madison Nationals on the track with Frankie Andreu in what year?
So 1985, it was funny. We had the same coach at the time, Roger Young, who was a brilliant coach in some ways, and really, you know, I don't know where, I think he's out in LA right now, but he put us together for that thing. Frankie had another regular partner, and he was riding really well, and his partner couldn't come, and so Raj said, you know, you should ride Chris, because he's flying right now. And so we were both going really well, but we each had a broken wrist, so we had a hard time with the Madison changes.
And it was so on the, it was on it. The chain, your wrists were right and left, or no, wait, which wrist, wait, I'm trying to, which would be the bad wrists to have? I guess either one is bad because you have to come in and out.
Yeah. I don't remember which change it was that it was bad on, but it was just making it really hard for us. And, so we just got it right away that the only way we were going to do well was to attack. And we, you know, we timed it right. We had the right form and everything. And so we lapped everyone. And back then, if you took a lap, you stayed a lap up unless people unlapped themselves. And so we were able to hang on to all the attacks after that and took it. And it was Frankie's first senior title and my only one. So it was awesome.
Well done. You part of the year you base yourself in Bloomington, Indiana. Are you still involved with the Cutter program or with the race?
Really, really not. It's been quite a while, and not that it's nothing negative at all. It's just, you know, for a number of years after I quit riding, I stayed involved and helped out and coached, and that was a lot of fun. And I think I really just hit a point with that where, you know, I didn't have the enthusiasm for it anymore, and it really, you know, I saw that, and I saw that there were a lot of other younger guys that had more enthusiasm that should be involved, and luckily they were there to step forward, and a lot of guys have been carrying it since then, and good on them. It's great.
The race not only breeds and propels people to do bike racing. But, you know, you work in the cycling industry, and I know a couple other people who raced in the race who are at one way or another involved in bicycling somehow as a vocation.
Yeah, there's a ton of people that have stayed in it one way or another. You know, the guys like you mentioned who are still racing, people in the industry and all that. And it, you know, it just gets people more familiar with the sport, just that it's fun. And I think a lot of low five riders, even if they never race again, a lot of them still ride their bikes and stay fit. I run into guys I used to ride with all the time, and a lot of them still ride and love it.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention, while we wrap it up here, is you are in the Little 500 Hall of Fame, yes?
Yeah, which is, you know, it's been a long time, and it's, you know, not like too many people know that or there's any big value in it. But, yeah, you're elected, at least when I was elected, it's by your peers, and there's a lot of little jealousies and political stuff and all that. And so really to get in means that a lot of people not necessarily liked you, but, you know, at minimum they had respect for you.
Mm-hmm.
What you accomplished in that little venue of life. And so for me, that's not something I'd talk about much, but I'm proud of it.
Yeah. Well, I think the legacy of you were there and at the onset of the Cutter program and weren't even a rider, but were invested enough and it was important enough to you to start that Cutter team that, as we said, has won 12 races since 84. So you were there at the beginning of that.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Again, there's lots of other people that were involved. I'm proud to have done my bit for it. And as you've seen over time, you get to the race a lot. You know, there are lots of other independent teams that really didn't exist before that, that now exist, that some have been around for a long time, some come and go. But I think it's pulled a lot of different people in that never would have done the event if you had to do it via a fraternity or a residence hall organization. So I think that's another part of the whole Cutter movement that's been really positive.
Mm-hmm. The race started as a Greek event in 1951, and then they started to let housing or resident hall teams form up. But the Cutters was really sort of the first. Was it the first independent team like that, not affiliated with a house or a honors college or anything?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't the first, but I think it was. I hesitate, you know, history goes back so far, you don't know, don't know what you don't know, but certainly the first to really have continuity where people, you know, recognize the team and it continued and was successful.
What's the races, is coming up soon. Do you have any intel or what do you hear about the team and their chances this year?
Oh God, I'm the last guy to ask. I know the Cutters will be really competitive, but that's about all I know about it. I'm going to miss the race this year, which is always a bummer. It doesn't happen too often, and I live, you know, what, a mile or so from the track. So it's, but I'm off to another cycling mecca. I think on Little 5 Day, I'll be on Alpe d'Huez.
Ah, all right. Well, we'll remember you on race day, Chris. And I don't know. We'll break into your house and have a party.
Great. Take pictures.
All right, Chris Gutowski, thank you for being on the Two Johns podcast.
It was a pleasure, John. Good luck going forward. As you brush your shoes, you stand before your mirror.
And everything looks so cold when you're walking down. just like thunder, and everything is so complete.